This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West by Gregory Maguire, narrated by John McDonough. This work is copyrighted 1995 by Gregory Maguire. This recording is copyrighted 2000 by Recorded Books Incorporated. When Dorothy triumphed over the Wicked Witch of the West in The Wizard of Oz, we heard only Dorothy's side of the story. But what about her arch-nemesis, the mysterious witch? Where did she come from? And why was she so wicked? Gregory Maguire opens this novel with three quotes, the first from Daniel Defoe. "'Tis very strange men should be so fond of being thought wickeder than they are." The next from Leo Tolstoy. "In historical events, great men, so-called, are but the labels that serve to give a name to an event, and, like labels, they have the last possible connection with the event itself. Every action of theirs that seems to them an act of their own free will is, in an historical sense, not free at all, but in bondage to the whole course of the previous history, and predestined from all eternity." And last, from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum, "Well," said the head, "I will give you my answer. You have no right to expect me to send you back to Kansas unless you do something for me in return. In this country everyone must pay for everything he gets. If you wish me to use my magic power to send you home again, you must do something for me first. Help me, and I will help you." "What must I do?" asked the girl. "Kill the Wicked Witch of the West," answered Oz. And now, Wicked.
Prologue. On the Yellow Brick Road. A mile above Oz, the witch balanced on the wind's forward edge, as if she were a green fleck of the land itself, flung up and sent wheeling away by the turbulent air. White and purple summer thunderheads mounded around her. Below, the yellow brick road looped back on itself like a relaxed noose. Though winter storms and the crowbars of agitators had torn up the road, still it led relentlessly to the Emerald City. The witch could see the companions trudging along, maneuvering around the buckled sections, skirting trenches, skipping when the way was clear. They seemed oblivious of their fate. But it was not up to the witch to enlighten them. She used the broom as a sort of balustrade, stepping down from the sky like one of her flying monkeys. She finished up on the topmost bough of a black willow tree. Beneath, hidden by the fronds, her prey had paused to take their rest. The witch tucked her broom under her arm. Crab-like and quiet, she scuttled down a little at a time until she was a mere 20 feet above them. Wind moved the dangling tendrils of the tree. The witch stared and listened. There were four of them. She could see a huge cat of some sort, a lion, was it, and a shiny woodman. The tin woodman was picking nits out of the lion's mane, and the lion was muttering and squirming from the aggravation. An animated scarecrow lolled nearby, blowing dandelion heads into the wind. The girl was out of sight behind shifting curtains of the willow. "Of course, to hear them tell it, it is the surviving sister who is the crazy one," said the lion. "What a witch! Psychologically warped, possessed by demons, insane, not a pretty picture." "She was castrated at birth," replied the Tin Woodman calmly. "She was born hermaphroditic, or maybe entirely male." "Oh, you see castration everywhere you look," said the lion. "I'm only repeating what folks say," said the Tin Woodman. "Everyone is entitled to an opinion," said the lion airily. "She was deprived of a mother's love, is how I've heard it. She was an abused child. She was addicted to medicine for her skin condition. "She has been unlucky in love," said the Tin Woodman, "like the rest of us." The Tin Woodman paused and placed his hand on the center of his chest, as if in grief. "She's a woman who prefers the company of other women," said the Scarecrow, sitting up. "She's the spurned lover of a married man. She is a married man." The witch was so stunned that she nearly lost her grip on the branch. The last thing she ever cared for was gossip, yet she had been out of touch for so long that she was astonished at the vigorous opinions of these random nobodies. "She's a despot, a dangerous tyrant," said the Lion with conviction. The Tin Woodman pulled harder than was necessary on a lock of mane. "Everything's dangerous to you, you craven thing. I hear she's a champion of home rule for the so-called Winkies. Whoever she is, she must surely be grieving the death of her sister," said the child, in a somber voice, too rich, too sincere for one so young. The witch's skin crawled. "Don't go feeling sympathetic now. I certainly can't," the Tin Woodman sniffed, a bit cynically. "But Dorothy's right," said the Scarecrow. "No one is exempt from grief." The witch was deeply irked by their patronizing speculations. She moved around the trunk of the tree, stretching to catch a glimpse of the child. The wind was picking up, and the Scarecrow shivered. While the Tin Woodman continued fussing over the lion's tresses, he leaned against the lion, who held him tenderly. "Storm on the horizon," said the Scarecrow. Miles off, thunder echoed. "There is a witch on the horizon," said the Tin Woodman, tickling the lion. The lion got spooked and rolled on top of the Scarecrow, whimpering, and the Tin Woodman collapsed on top of them both. "Good friends, should we be wary of that storm?" said the girl. The rising winds moved the curtain of greenery at last, and the witch caught sight of the girl. She was sitting with her feet tucked underneath her, and her arms wrapped around her knees. She was not a dainty thing, but a good-sized farm girl, dressed in blue and white checks and a pinafore. In her lap, a vile little dog cowered and whined. "The storm makes you skittish. It's natural after what you've been through," said the Tin Woodman. "Relax." The witch's fingers dug into the bark of the tree. She still could not see the girl's face, just her strong forearms and the crown of her head, where her dark hair was pulled back into pigtails. Was she to be taken seriously, or was she merely a blow-away dandelion seed, caught on the wrong side of the wind? If she could see the girl's face, the witch felt she might know. But as the witch craned outward from the trunk, the girl at the same time twisted her face, turning away. "That storm is coming closer and in a hurry." The feeling in her voice rose as the wind rose. She had a throaty vehemence, like someone arguing through the threat of impending tears. "I know storms. I know how they come upon you." "We're safer here," said the Tin Woodman. "Certainly we are not," answered the girl, "because this tree is the highest point around, and if lightning is to strike, it will strike here." She clutched her dog. "Didn't we see a shed farther up the road? Come, come, Scarecrow. If there's lightning, you'll burn the fastest. Come on." She was up and running in an ungainly way, and her companions followed in a mounting panic. As the first hard drops of rain fell, the witch caught sight not of the girl's face, but of the shoes. Her sister's shoes. They sparkled even in the darkening afternoon. They sparkled like yellow diamonds, and embers of blood, and thorny stars. If she had seen the shoes first, The witch would never have been able to listen to the girl or her friends. But the girl's legs had been tucked beneath her skirt. Now the witch was reminded of her need. The shoes should be hers. Hadn't she endured enough? Hadn't she earned them? The witch would fall on the girl from the sky and wrestle those shoes off her impertinent feet, if only she could. But the storm from which the companions raced, farther and faster along the yellow brick road, troubled the witch more than it did the girl, who had gone through rain, and the scarecrow, whom lightning could burn. The witch could not venture out in such a vicious, insinuating wetness. Instead, she had to tuck herself between some exposed roots of the black willow tree, where no water could endanger her, and wait for the storm to pass. She would emerge. She always had before. The punishing political climate of Oz had beat her down, dried her up, tossed her away. Like a seedling she had drifted, apparently too desiccated ever to take root. But surely the curse was on the land of Oz, not on her. Though Oz had given her a twisted life, hadn't it also made her capable? No matter that the companions had hurried away, the witch could wait. They would meet again. Part 1. Munchkinlanders. The Root of Evil. From the crumpled bed, the wife said, "I think today's the day. Look how low I've gone." "Today? That would be like you. Perverse and inconvenient," said her husband, teasing her, standing at the doorway and looking outward over the lake, the fields, the forested slopes beyond. He could just make out the chimneys of Rush Margins, breakfast fires smoking. "The worst possible moment for my ministry. Naturally." The wife yawned. "There's not a lot of choice involved, from what I hear. Your body gets this big, and it takes over. If you can't accommodate it, sweetheart, you just get out of its way. It's on a track of its own, and nothing stops it now." She pushed herself up, trying to see over the rise of her belly. "I feel like a hostage to myself, or to the baby." "Exert some self-control." He came to her side and helped her sit up. "Think of it as a spiritual exercise. Custody of the senses, bodily as well as ethical continence." "Self-control?" she laughed, inching toward the edge of the bed. "I have no self left. I'm only a host for the parasite. Where's my self, anyway? Where'd I leave that tired old thing?" "Think of me." His tone had changed. He meant this. "Frex," she headed him off. "When the volcano's ready, there's no priest in the world can pray it quiet." "What will my fellow ministers think?" "They'll get together and say, 'Brother Frex Barr, did you allow your wife to deliver your first child when you had a community problem to solve? How inconsiderate of you. It shows a lack of authority. You're fired from the position.'" She was ribbing him now, for there was no one to fire him. The nearest bishop was too distant to pay attention to the particulars of a Unionist cleric in the hinterland. "It's just such terrible timing." "I do think you bear half the blame for the timing," she said. "I mean, after all, Frex." "That's how the thinking goes, but I wonder." "You wonder?" She laughed, her head going far back. The line from her ear to the hollow below her throat reminded Frex of an elegant silver ladle. Even in morning disarray, with a belly like a scow, she was majestically good-looking. Her hair had the bright lacquered look of wet fallen oak leaves in sunlight. He blamed her for being born to privilege, and admired her efforts to overcome it. And all the while he loved her, too. "You mean you wonder if you're the father?" She grabbed the bedstead. Frex took hold of her other arm and hauled her half upright. "Or do you question the fatherliness of men in general?" She stood, mammoth, an ambulatory island. Moving out the door at a slug's pace, she laughed at such an idea. He could hear her laughing from the outhouse, even as he began to dress for the day's battle. Frex combed his beard and oiled his scalp. He fastened a clasp of bone and rawhide at the nape of his neck to keep the hair out of his face, because his expressions today had to be readable from a distance. There could be no fuzziness to his meaning. He applied some coal dust to darken his eyebrows, a smear of red wax on his flat cheeks. He shaded his lips. A handsome priest attracted more penitents than a homely one. In the kitchen yard, Melina floated gently, not with the normal gravity of pregnancy, but as if inflated, a huge balloon trailing its strings through the dirt. She carried a skillet in one hand and a few eggs and the whiskery tips of autumn chives in the other. She sang to herself, but only in short phrases. Frex wasn't meant to hear her. His sober gown buttoned tight to the collar, his sandals strapped on over leggings, Frex took from its hiding place, beneath a chest of drawers, the report sent to him from his fellow minister over in the village of Three Dead Trees. He hid the brown pages within his sash. He had been keeping them from his wife, afraid that she would want to come along, to see the fun, if it was amusing, or to suffer the thrill of it if it was terrifying. As Frex breathed deeply, readying his lungs for a day of oratory, Melina dangled a wooden spoon in the skillet and stirred the eggs. The tinkle of cowbells sounded across the lake. She did not listen, or she listened but to something else, to something inside her. It was sound without melody, like dream music, remembered for its effect, but not for its harmonic distresses and recoveries. She imagined it was the child inside her humming for happiness. She knew he would be a singing child. Melina heard Frex inside, beginning to extemporize, warming up, calling forth the rolling phrases of his argument, convincing himself again of his righteousness. How did that proverb go, the one that Nanny sing-songed to her years ago in the nursery? Born in the morning, woe without warning. Afternoon child, woeful and wild. Born in the evening, woe ends in grieving. Night baby borning, same as the morning. But she remembered this as a joke, fondly. Woe is the natural end of life, yet we go on having babies. No, said Nanny, an echo in Melina's mind, and editorializing as usual. No, no, you pretty little pampered hussy. We don't go on having babies, that's quite apparent. We only have babies when we're young enough not to know how grim life turns out. Once we really get the full measure of it, we're slow learners, we women, we dry up in disgust and sensibly halt production. But men don't dry up, Melina objected. They can father to the death. Ah, we're slow learners, Nanny countered, but they can't learn at all. Breakfast, said Melina, spooning eggs onto a wooden plate. Her son would not be as dull as most men. She would raise him up to defy the onward progress of woe. "It is a time of crisis for our society," recited Frex. For a man who condemned worldly pleasures, he ate with elegance. She loved to watch the arabesque of fingers and two forks. She suspected that beneath his righteous asceticism, he possessed a hidden longing for the easy life. "Every day is a great crisis for our society." She was being flip, answering him in the terms men use. Dear thick thing, he didn't hear the irony in her voice. "We stand at a crossroads. Idolatry looms. Traditional values in jeopardy. Truth under siege and virtue abandoned." He wasn't talking to her so much as practicing his tirade against the coming spectacle of violence and magic. There was a side to Frex that verged on despair. Unlike most men, he was able to channel it to benefit his life's work. With some difficulty, she set herself down on a bench. Whole choruses were singing wordlessly inside her head. Was this common for every labor and delivery? She would have liked to ask the nosy local women who would come around this afternoon, growling shyly at her condition. But she didn't dare. She couldn't jettison her pretty accent, which they found affected. But she could avoid sounding ignorant about these basic matters. Frex noticed her silence. "You're not angry I'm leaving you today?" "Angry?" She raised her eyebrows as if she had never encountered the concept before. "History crawls along on the peg legs of small individual lives," said Frex. "And at the same time, larger eternal forces converge. You can't attend to both arenas at once." "Our child may not have a small life." "Now isn't the time to argue. Do you want to distract me from holy work today? We're facing the presence of real evil in Rush Margins. I couldn't live with myself if I ignored it." He meant this, and for such intensity, she had fallen in love with him. But she hated him for it, too, of course. "Threats come, they'll come again." Her last word on the subject. "Your son will only be born once. And if this watery upheaval inside is any indication, I think it's today." "There will be other children." She turned away, so he could not see the rage in her face. But she couldn't sustain the fury at him. Perhaps this was her moral failing. She wasn't much given to worrying about moral failings as a rule. Having a minister as a husband seemed to stir enough religious thought for one couple. She lapsed sullenly into silence. Frex nibbled at his meal. "It's the devil," said Frex, sighing. "The devil is coming." "Don't say a thing like that on a day our child is expected." "I mean the temptation in Rush Margins. And you know what I mean, Melina. Words are words, and what's said is said," she answered. "I don't require all your attention, Frex, but I do need some of it." She dropped the skillet with a crash on the bench that stood against the cottage wall. "Well, and likewise," he said, "what do you think I'm up against today? How can I convince my flock to turn away from the razzle-dazzle spectacle of idolatry? I will probably come back tonight, having lost to a smarter attraction. You might achieve a child today. I look forward to failure." Still, as he said this, he looked proud. To fail in the cause of a high moral concern was satisfying to him. How could it compare with the flesh, blood, mess, and noise of having a baby? He stood at last to leave. A wind came up over the lake now, smudging the topmost reaches of the columns of kitchen smoke. They looked, thought Melina, like funnels of water swirling down drains in narrowing, focusing spirals. "Be well, my love," said Frex, although he had his stern public expression on from forehead to toes. "Yes," Melina sighed. The child punched her deep down, and she had to hurry to the outhouse again. "Be holy, and I'll be thinking of you, my backbone, my breastplate. And also try not to be killed." "The will of the unnamed God," said Frex. "My will, too," she said blasphemously. "Apply your will to that which deserves it," he answered. Now he was the minister and she the sinner, an arrangement she did not particularly enjoy. "Goodbye," she said, and chose the stink and relief of the outhouse over standing to wave him out of sight as he strode along the road to Rush Margins. The Clock of the Time Dragon. Frex was more concerned for Melina than she knew. He stopped at the first fisherman's hut he saw and spoke with the man at the half-door. Could a woman or two spend the day and, if needed, the night with Melina? It would be a kindness. Frex nodded with a wince of gratitude, acknowledging without words that Melina was not a great favorite in these parts. Then, before continuing around the end of Illswater and over to Rush Margins, he stopped at a fallen tree and drew two letters from his sash. The writer was a distant cousin of Frex's, also a minister. Weeks earlier, the cousin had spent time and valuable ink on a description of what was being called the Clock of the Time Dragon. Frex prepared himself for the day's holy campaign by rereading about the idle clock. "I write in haste, Brother Frexbar, to catch my impressions before they fade. The Clock of the Time Dragon is mounted on a wagon and stands as high as a giraffe. It is nothing more than a tottering, freestanding theater, punched on all four sides with alcoves and proscenium arches. On the flat roof is a clockwork dragon, an invention of green painted leather, silvery claws, ruby-jeweled eyes. Its skin is made of hundreds of overlapping discs of copper, bronze, and iron. Beneath the flexible folds of its scales is an armature controlled by clockwork. The Time Dragon circles on its pedestal, flexes its narrow, leathery wings — they make a sound like a bellows — and belches out sulphurous balls of flaming orange stink. Below, featured in the dozens of doorways, windows, and porches, are puppets, marionettes, figurines, creatures of folk tale, caricatures of peasants and royalty alike, animals and fairies and saints. Our Unionist saints, Brother Frexbar, stolen out from underneath us. I get enraged. The figures move on sprockets. They wheel in and out of doorways. They bend at the waist. They dance and dawdle and dally with each other. Who had engendered this time dragon, this fake oracle, this propaganda tool for wickedness that challenged the power of unionism and of the unnamed god? The clock's handlers were a dwarf and some narrow-waisted minions who seemed to have only enough brain capacity among them to pass a hat. Who else was benefiting besides the dwarf and his beauty boys? The cousin's second letter had warned that the clock was making its way next to Rush Margins. It had told a more specific story. The entertainment began with a thrum of strings and a rattle of bones. The crowd pushed close, ooing. Within the lighted window of a stage, we saw a marriage bed with a puppet wife and husband. The husband was asleep, and the wife sighed. She made a motion with her carved hands, to suggest that her husband was disappointingly small. The audience shrieked with laughter. The puppet wife went to sleep herself. When she was snoring, the puppet husband sneaked out of bed. At this point, up above, the dragon turned on its base and pointed its talons into the crowd, indicating, without a doubt, a humble well-digger named Grine, who has been a faithful, if inattentive, husband. Then the dragon reared back and stretched two fingers in a come-hither gesture, isolating a widow named Letta and her snaggle-toothed maiden daughter. The crowd hushed and fell away from Grine, Letta, and the blushing maid, as if they had suddenly been inflicted with running sores. The dragon rested again, but draped a wing over another archway, which lit up to reveal the puppet husband, wandering out in the night. Along came a puppet widow with sprigged hair and high color, dragging along a protesting, flinty-toothed daughter. The widow kissed the puppet husband and pulled off his leather trousers. He was equipped with two full sets of male goods, one in the front and another hanging off the base of his spine. The widow positioned her daughter on the abbreviated prong in the front, and herself took advantage of the more menacing arrangement in the rear. The three puppets bucked and rocked, emitting squeals of glee. When the puppet widow and her daughter were through, they dismounted and kissed the adulterous puppet husband. Then they kneed him simultaneously fore and aft. He swung on springs and hinges, trying to hold all his wounded parts. The audience roared. Grine, the actual well-digger, sweated drops as big as grapes. Letta pretended to guffaw, but her daughter had already disappeared from shame. Before the evening was out, Grine was set upon by his agitated neighbors and investigated for the grotesque anomaly. Letta was shunned. Her daughter seems to have vanished entirely. We suspect the worst. At least Grine wasn't killed. Yet who can say how our souls have been stamped by witnessing such a cruel drama? All souls are hostages to their human envelopes, but souls must decay and suffer at such indignity. Don't you agree? Sometimes it seemed to Frex that every itinerant witch and toothless gibbering seer in Oz, who could perform even the most transparent of spells, had seized on the outback district of Wend Hardings to scratch out a trade. He knew that folks from Rush Margins were humble, their lives were hard and their hopes few. As the drought dragged on, their traditional unionist faith was eroding. Frex was aware that the clock of the Time Dragon combined the appeals of ingenuity and magic, and he would have to call on his deepest reserves of religious conviction to overcome it. If his congregation should prove vulnerable to the so-called pleasure faith, succumbing to spectacle and violence, well, what next? He would prevail. He was their minister. He had pulled their teeth and buried their babies and blessed their kitchen pots for years now. He had abased himself in their names. He had wandered with an unkempt beard and a begging bowl from hamlet to hamlet, leaving poor Melina alone in the minister's lodge for weeks at a time. He had sacrificed for them. They couldn't be swayed by this time dragon creature. They owed him. He moved on, shoulders squared, jaw set, stomach in a sour uproar. The sky was brown with flying sand and grit. The wind rushed high over the hills with the sound of a tremulous wail, as if pushing through some fissure of rock on a ridge beyond any Frex could see. The Birth of a Witch. It was nearly evening by the time Frex had worked up the courage to enter the ramshackle hamlet of Rush Margins. He was in a deep sweat. He hit his heels to the ground and pumped his clenched fists and called out in a hoarse, carrying tone, "Hist! O ye of small confidence! Gather while ye may, for temptation is abroad, to try ye sorely." The words were archaic, even ridiculous, but they worked. Here came the sullen fishermen, dragging their empty nets up from the dock. Here came the subsistence farmers, whose hard-scrabble plots had borne little during this dry year. Before he had even begun, they all looked guilty as sin. They followed him to the rickety steps of the canoe repair house. Frex knew that everyone expected this evil clock to arrive at any instant. Gossip was as contagious as the plague. He yelled at them for their thirsty anticipation. "Ye are dull as toddlers, reaching their hands to touch the pretty embers. Ye are as if spawn of dragon womb, ready to suck on teats of fire." These were time-worn scriptural imprecations, and they fell a little flat tonight. He was tired and not at his best. "Brother Frexbar," said Fee, the mayor of Rush Margins, "could you perhaps tone down your harangue until we get a chance to see what fresh new form temptation might take?" "You have no mettle to resist new forms," said Frex, spitting. "Haven't you been our able teacher these several years?" said Pfee. "We've hardly had such a good chance to prove ourselves against sin. We're looking forward to the spiritual test of it all." The fishermen laughed and jeered, and Frex intensified his glower. But at the sound of unfamiliar wheels in the stony ruts of the road, they all turned their heads and fell silent. He had lost their attention before he had gotten started. The clock was being drawn by four horses and escorted by the dwarf and his cohort of young thugs. Its broad roof was crowned by the dragon, but what a beast! It looked poised as if ready to spring, as if indeed invested with life. The skin of the house was decorated in carnival colors, burnished with gold leaf. The fisherman gaped as it drew near. Before the dwarf could announce the time of the performance, before the crowd of youths could draw out their clubs, Frex leaped on the lower step of the thing, a fold-down stage on hinges. "Why is this thing called a clock? The only clock face it has is flat, dull, and lost in all that distracting detail. Furthermore, the hands don't move. Look, see for yourselves. They're painted to remain at 1 minute before midnight. All you'll see here is mechanics, my friends. I know this for a fact. You'll see mechanical cornfields growing, moons waxing and waning, a volcano to spew a soft red cloth done up with black and red sequins. With all this tick-tocky business, why not have a pair of circulating arms on the clock face? Why not? I ask you, I'm asking you, yes, you, Gonette, and you, Stoy, and you, Peripa, why no real clock here?" They were not listening. Gonette and Stoy and Peripa, nor were the others. They were too busy staring in anticipation. "The answer, of course, is that the clock isn't meant to measure earthly time, but the time of the soul. Redemption and condemnation time. For the soul, each instant is always a minute short of judgment." "1 minute short of judgment, my friends. If you died in the next 60 seconds, would you want to spend eternity in the suffocating depths reserved for idolaters?" "Awful lot of noise in the neighborhood tonight," said someone in the shadows, and the spectators laughed. Above Frex, he whirled to see, from a little door had emerged a small, yapping puppet dog, its hair dark and as tightly curled as Frex's own. The dog bounced on a spring, and the pitch of its chatter was annoyingly high. The laughter grew. Evening fell harder, and it was less easy for Frex to tell who was laughing, who now was shouting for him to move aside so they could see. He wouldn't move, so he was bundled unceremoniously from his perch. The dwarf gave a poetic welcome. "All our lives are activity without meaning. We burrow rat-like into life, and we squirm rat-like through it, and rat-like we are flung into our graves at the end. Now and then, why shouldn't we hear a voice of prophecy, or see a miracle play? Beneath the apparent sham and indignity of our rat-like lives, a humble pattern and meaning still applies. Come nearer, my good people, and watch what a little extra knowledge augurs for your lives. The time dragon sees before and beyond, and within the truth of your sorry span of years here. Look at what it shows you." The crowd pushed forward. The moon had risen, its light like the eye of an angry, vengeful god. "Give over! Let me go!" Frex called. It was worse than he had thought. He had never been manhandled by his own congregation. The clock unfolded a story about a publicly pious man with lamb's-wool beard and dark, curly locks, who preached simplicity, poverty, and generosity, while keeping a hidden coffer of gold and emeralds in the double-hinged bosom of a weak-chinned daughter of blue-blood society. The scoundrel was run through with a long iron stake in a most indelicate way, and served up to his hungry flock as roast flank of minister. "This panders to your basest instincts," Frex yelled, his arms folded and his face magenta with fury. But now that darkness was almost total, someone came up from behind him to silence him. An arm encircled his neck. He twisted to see which damned parishioner took such liberties, but all the faces were cloaked by hoods. He was kneed in the groin and doubled over, his face in the dirt. A foot kicked him square between the buttocks, and his bowels released. The rest of the crowd, however, was not watching. They were howling with mirth at some other entertainment put on by the clock dragon. A sympathetic woman in a widow's shawl grabbed his arm and led him away. He was too fouled, too much in pain to straighten up and see who it was. "I'll put you down in the root cellar, I will, under a burlap," crooned the good wife. "For they'll be after you tonight with pitchforks, the way that thing is behaving itself. They'll look for you in your lodge, but they won't look in my keeping room." "Melina," he croaked, "they'll find her." "She'll be seen to," said his neighbor. "We women can manage that much, I guess." In the minister's lodge, Melina struggled with consciousness as a pair of midwives went in and out of focus before her. One was a fishwife, the other a palsied crone. They took turns feeling her forehead, peering between her legs, and stealing glances at the few beautiful trinkets and treasures Melina had managed to bring here from Colwyn grounds.
"You chew that paste of pinlobble leaves, ducky, you do that. You'll be unconscious before you know it," said the fishwife. "You'll relax, out will pop the little sweetheart, and all will be well in the morning. Thought you would smell of rose water and fairy dew, but you stink like the rest of us. Chew on, my ducky, chew on."
At the sound of a knock, the crone looked up guiltily from the chest she was kneeling before and rummaging through. She let the lid close with a bang, and affected a position of prayer, eyes closed.
"Enter," she called.
a maiden with tender skin and high color came in.
"Oh, I hoped someone would be here," she said. "How is she?"
"Nearly out, and so is the babe," answered the fishwife. "An hour more, I reckon."
"Well, I'm told to warn you. The men are drunk and on the prowl. They've been riled up by that dragon of the magic clock, you know, and they're looking for Frex to kill him. The clock said to. They'll likely stagger out here. We'd better get the wife safely away. Can she be moved?"
"No, I cannot be moved," thought Melina. "And if the peasants find Frex, tell them to kill him good and hard for me, for I never knew a pain so extraordinary that it made me see the blood behind my own eyes. Kill him for doing this to me." At this thought, she smiled in a moment of relief and passed out.
"Let's leave her here and run for it," said the maiden. "The clock said to kill her, too, and the little dragon she's going to give birth to. I don't want to get caught."
"We've got our own reputations to uphold," said the fishwife. "We can't abandon the fancy lady thing in mid-delivery. I don't care what any clock says."
The crone, her head back in the chest, said,
"Anyone for some real lace from Gilliken? There's a hay cart in the lower field, but let's do it now," said the fishwife. "Come, help me fetch it. You old mother hag, get your face out of the linens and come dampen this pretty pink brow. Right-o, now we go."
A few minutes later, the crone, the wife, and the maiden were trundling the hay cart along a rarely used track through the spindles and bracken of the autumn woods. The wind had picked up. It whistled over the treeless foreheads of the cloth hills. Melina, sprawled in blankets, heaved and moaned in unconscious pain. They heard a drunken mob pass with pitchforks and torches, and the women stood silent and terrified, listening to the slurred curses. Then they pressed on with greater urgency until they came upon a foggy copse, the edge of the graveyard for unconsecrated corpses. Within it they saw the blurred outlines of the clock. It had been left here for safekeeping by the dwarf. No fool he. He could guess this particular corner of the world was the last place jumpy villagers would seek tonight.
"The dwarf and his boykins were drinking in the tavern, too," said the maiden breathlessly. "There's no one here to stop us."
The crone said, "So you've been peering in the tavern windows at the men, you slut."
She pushed open the door in the back of the clock. She found a crawl space. Pendulums hung ominously in the gloom. Huge toothed wheels looked primed to slice any trespasser into sausage rounds.
"Come on, drag her in," said the crone.
The night of torches and fog gave way at dawn to broad bluffs of thundercloud, dancing skeletons of lightning. Glimpses of blue sky appeared briefly, though sometimes it rained so hard that it seemed more like mud drops falling than water. The midwives, crawling on hands and knees out of the back of the clock wagon, had their little discharge at last. They protected the infant from the dripping gutter.
"Look, a rainbow," said the senior, bobbing her head. A sickly scarf of colored light hung in the sky.
What they saw, rubbing the caul and blood off the skin, was it just a trick of the light? After all, following the storm, the grass did seem to throb with its own color. The roses zinged and hovered with crazy glory on their stems. But even with these effects of light and atmosphere, the midwives couldn't deny what they saw. Beneath the spit of the mother's fluids, the infant glistened a scandalous shade of pale emerald. There was no wail, no bark of newborn outrage. The child opened its mouth, breathed, and then kept its own counsel.
"Wine, you fiend," said the crone. "It's your first job."
The baby shirked its obligations.
"Another willful boy," said the fishwife, sighing. "Shall we kill it?" "Don't be so nasty to it," said the crone. "It's a girl."
"Ha!" said the bleary-eyed maiden. "Look again. There's the weather vane." For a minute, they were in disagreement, even with the child naked before them. Only after a second and third rub was it clear that the child was indeed feminine. Perhaps in labor some bit of organic effluvia had become caught and quickly dried in the cloven place. Once toweled, she was observed to be prettily formed, with a long, elegant head, forearms nicely turned out, clever pinching little buttocks, cunning fingers with scratchy little nails, and an undeniable green cast to the skin. There was a salmon blush in the cheeks and belly, a beige effect around the clenched eyelids, a tawny stripe on the scalp showing the pattern of eventual hair, but the primary effect was vegetable. "Look what we get for our troubles," said the maiden. "A little green pat of butter. Why don't we kill it? You know what people will say."
"I think it's rotten," said the fishwife, and checked for the root of a tail, counted fingers and toes. "It smells like dung."
"That is dung you're smelling, you idiot. You're squatting in a cow patty pie."
"It's sick. It's feeble. That's why the color. Lose it in the puddle. Drown the thing. She'll never know. She'll be out for hours in her ladylike faints."
They giggled. They cradled the infant in the crook of their arms, passing it around to test it for weight and balance. To kill it was the kindest course of action. The question was how. Then the child yawned, and the fishwife absent-mindedly gave it a finger to nurse on, and the child bit the finger off at the second knuckle. It almost choked on the gush of blood. The digit dropped out of its mouth into the mud like a bobbin. The women catapulted into action. The fishwife lunged to strangle the girl, and the crone and the maiden flared up in defense. The finger was dug out of the mire and shoved in an apron pocket, possibly to sew back onto the hand that had lost it.
"It's a cock! She just realized she didn't have one," screeched the maiden, and fell on the ground laughing.
"Oh, beware the stupid boy first tries to please himself with her. She'll snip his young sprout off for a souvenir." The midwives crawled back into the clock and dropped the thing at its mother's breast, afraid to consider mercy murder for fear of what else the baby might bite.
"Maybe she'll chop the tit next. That'll bring her drowsy frailness around quick enough," the crone chuckled. "Though what a child that sips blood even before its first suck of mother's milk."
They left a pipkin of water nearby, and under cover of the next squall, they went squelching away to find their sons and husbands and brothers, and berate and beat them if they were available, or bury them if not. In the shadows, the infant stared overhead at the oiled and regular teeth of time's clock. Maladies and Remedies. For days, Melina couldn't bear to look at the thing. She held it as a mother must. She waited for the groundwater of maternal affection to rise and overwhelm her. She did not weep. She chewed pinlobble leaves to float away from the disaster. It was a she. It was a her. Melina practiced conversions in her thinking when she was alone. The twitching, unhappy bundle was not male. It was not neutered. It was a female. It slept, looking like a heap of cabbage leaves washed and left to drain on the table. In a panic, Melina wrote to Colwyn Grounds to drag Nanny from her retirement. Frex went ahead in a carriage to collect Nanny from the way station at Stone's Bar End. On the trip back, Nanny asked Frex what was wrong.
"What is wrong?" he sighed, and was lost in thought.
Nanny realized she had chosen her words poorly. Now Frex was distracted. He began to mumble in a general way about the nature of evil, a vacuum set up by the inexplicable absence of the unnamed God, and into which spiritual poison must rush, a vortex.
"I mean, what is the state of the child?" retorted Nanny explosively. "It's not the universe, but a single child I need to hear about, if I'm going to be any help. Why does Melina call for me instead of for her mother? Why is there no letter for her grandfather? He's the eminent Throp, for goodness sakes. Melina can't have forgotten her duties so thoroughly, or is life out there in the country worse than we thought?"
"It's worse than we thought," said Frex grimly. "The baby... You had better be prepared, Nanny, so you don't scream. The baby is damaged."
"Damaged?"
Nanny's grip on her valise tightened, and she looked out over the red-leafed pearl-fruit trees by the side of the road.
"Frex, tell me everything."
"It's a girl," said Frex.
"Damage indeed," said Nanny mockingly. But Frex, as usual, missed the dig. "Well, at least the family's title's preserved for another generation. Has she got all her limbs?"
"Yes."
"Any more than she needs?"
"No."
"Is she sucking?"
"We can't let it. It has extraordinary teeth, Nanny. It has shark's teeth or something like."
"Well, she won't be the first child to grow on a bottle or a rag instead of a tit. Don't worry about that."
"It's the wrong color," said Frex.
"What color is the wrong color?"
For a few moments, Frex could only shake his head. Nanny did not like him, and she would not like him, but she softened.
"Frex, it can't be that bad. There's always a way out. Tell Nanny."
"It's green," he finally said.
"Nanny, it's green as moss."
"She's green, you mean. It's a she, for heaven's sake."
"It's not for heaven's sake." Frex began to weep.
"Heaven is not improved by it, Nanny, and heaven does not approve. What are we to do?"
"Hush." Nanny detested weeping men.
"It can't be as bad as all that. There isn't a sniff of low blood in Melina's veins. Whatever blight the child has will respond to Nanny's treatment. Trust Nanny."
"I trusted in the unnamed God," sobbed Frex.
"We don't always work at cross purposes, God and Nanny," said Nanny.
She knew this was blasphemous, but she couldn't resist a jibe as long as Frex's resistance was down.
"But don't worry. I won't breathe a word to Melina's family. We'll sort this all out in a flash, and no one need know. The baby has a name?"
"Elphaba," he said.
"After St. Elphaba of the Waterfall?"
"Yes."
"A fine old name. You'll use the common nickname Fabula, I suppose?"
"Who even knows if she'll live long enough to grow into a nickname?" Frex sounded as if he hoped this would be the case.
"Interesting country. Are we in Wend Harding's yet?"
Nanny asked, to change the subject. But Frex had folded up inside, barely bothering to guide the horses onto the correct track. The country was filthy, depressed, peasant-ridden. Nanny began to wish she had not set out in her best traveling gown. Roadside robbers might expect to find gold on such a refined-looking older woman. And they would be right, for Nanny sported a golden garter stolen years ago from her ladyship's boudoir. What a humiliation if the garter should turn up these years later on Nanny's well-turned, if aging, thigh. But Nanny's fears were unfounded, for the carriage arrived without incident in the yard of the minister's cottage. "Let me see the baby first," said Nanny. "It will be easier and fairer on Melina if I know what we're dealing with." And this wasn't hard to arrange, as Melina was out cold, thanks to pinlobble leaves, while the baby in a basket on the table wailed softly. Nanny drew up a chair so she wouldn't hurt herself if she fainted dead away. "Frex, put the basket on the floor where I can look into it." Frex obliged, and then went to return the horses and carriage to Pfee, who rarely needed them for mayoral duties, but loaned them out to earn a little political capital. The infant was wrapped in linens, Nanny saw, and the baby's mouth and ears were strapped with a sling. The nose looked like a knob of bad mushroom poking up for air, and the eyes were open. Nanny leaned closer. The child couldn't be, what, 3 weeks old? Yet, as Nanny moved from side to side, looking at the profile of the forehead from this angle and that, so as to judge the shape of the mind, the girl's eyes tracked her back and forth. They were brown and rich, the color of overturned earth, flecked with mica. There was a network of fragile red lines at each soft angle where the eyelids met, as if the girl had been bursting the blood threads from the exertion of watching and understanding. And the skin, oh yes, the skin was green as sin. Not an ugly color, Nanny thought, just not a human color. She reached out and let her finger drift across the baby's cheek. The infant flinched, and her backbone arched, and the wrapping, which was tucked securely around the child from neck to toe, split open like a husk. Nanny gritted her teeth and was determined not to be cowed. The baby had exposed herself, sternum to groin, and the skin on her chest was the same remarkable color. "Have you even touched this child yet, you two?" murmured Nanny. She put her hand palm down on the child's heaving chest, her fingers covering the almost invisible baby nipples, then slid her hand down so she could check the apparatus below. The child was wet and soiled, but felt made according to standard design. The skin was the same miracle of pliant smoothness that Melina had possessed as an infant. "Come to Nanny, you horrid little thing, you!" Nanny leaned to pick the baby up, mess and all. The baby swiveled to avoid the touch. Her head beat itself against the rush bottom of the basket. "You've been dancing in the womb, I see," said Nanny. "I wonder to whose music? Such well-developed muscles." "No, you're not getting away from me. Come here, you little demon." "Nanny doesn't care. Nanny likes you." She was lying through her teeth, but unlike Frex, she believed some lies were sanctioned by heaven. And she got her hands on Elphaba and settled her on her lap. There Nanny waited, crooning, and every now and then looking away out the window, to recover herself and keep from vomiting. She rubbed the baby's belly to calm the girl down, but there was no calming her down, not yet anyway. Melina propped herself up on her elbows in the late afternoon when Nanny brought a tray with tea and bread. "I have made myself at home," said Nanny, "and I've made friends with your tiny darling. Now come to your senses, sweetheart, and let me give you a kiss." Oh, Nanny, Melina allowed herself to be coddled. Thank you for coming. Have you seen the little monster?
She's adorable, said Nanny.
Don't lie and don't be soft, said Melina. If you're going to help, you must be honest.
If I'm going to help, you must be honest, said Nanny.
We need not go into it now, but I will have to know everything, my sweet, so we can decide what's to be done. They sipped their tea, and because Elphaba had fallen asleep at last, it seemed for a few moments like the old days at Colwyn Grounds, when Melina would come home from afternoon walks with lithesome young gentry on the make, and boast of their masculine beauty to a nanny who pretended she had not noticed. In fact, as the weeks went on, Nanny noticed quite a few disturbing things about the baby. For one thing, Nanny tried to remove the baby's bandages, but Elphaba seemed intent on biting her own hands off, and the teeth inside that pretty thin-lipped mouth were indeed monstrous. She would bite a hole through the basket if she were left unfettered. She went after her own shoulder and scraped it raw. She looked as if she were strangling. "Can't a barber be had to pull the teeth out?" Nanny asked. "At least until the baby learns some self-control." "You're out of your mind," Melina said. "It will be all over the valley that the little marrow is green. We'll keep the jaw strapped up until we solve the skin problem." "However in the world did her skin come green?" Nanny wondered stupidly. For Melina blanched, and Frex reddened, and the baby held her breath, as if trying to turn blue to please them all. Nanny had to slap her to make her breathe again. Nanny interviewed Frex out in the yard. After the double blow of the birth and his public embarrassment, he was not yet up to professional engagements, and sat whittling praying beads out of oak, scoring and inscribing them with emblems of the namelessness of God. Nanny set Elphaba down inside. She had an unreasonable fear of being overheard by this infant, and worse, of being understood. And Nanny sat scooping out a pumpkin for supper.
"I don't suppose, Frex, that you have green in your family background," she began, knowing full well that Melina's powerful grandfather would have confirmed such a predisposition before agreeing to let his granddaughter marry a Unionist minister, of all the chances she had.
"Our family isn't about money or about earthly power," said Frex, taking no offence for once. "But I'm descended in a direct line from six ministers before me, father to son. We're as well regarded in spiritual circles as Melina's family is in parlours and at the court of Ozma. And no, there is no green anywhere. I never heard of such a thing before in any family."
Nanny nodded and said, "Well, all right, I was only asking. I know you're gooder than goblin martyrs." "But," Frex said humbly, "Nanny, I think I caused this thing to happen. My tongue slipped on the day of the birthday. I announced that the devil was coming. I meant the clock of the time dragon, but suppose those words unlocked room for the devil?"
"The child is no devil," snapped Nanny.
"She's no angel either," she thought, but kept it to herself.
"On the other hand," Frex continued, sounding more secure, "she may have been cursed by Melina accidentally, who took my remark the wrong way and wept about it. Maybe Melina opened up inside herself a window through which an unattached sprite entered and colored the child."
"On the very day she is to be born?" said Nanny. "That's a capable sprite. Is your goodness so exalted you attract the truly high-powered among the spirits of aberration?"
Frex shrugged. A few weeks earlier he would have nodded, but his confidence was shattered with his abject failure in rush margins. He did not dare suggest what he feared. The child's abnormality was a punishment for his failure to protect his flock from the pleasure faith.
"Well," Nanny asked practically,
"if through a curse the goods were damaged, then through what might the ill be overturned?"
"An exorcism," said Frex.
"Are you empowered?"
"If I'm successful at changing her, we'll know that I'm empowered," said Frex.
But now that he had a goal, his spirits brightened. He would spend some days in fasting, rehearsing prayers, and collecting supplies for the arcane ritual. When he was off in the woods and Elphaba napping, Nanny perched on the side of Melina's hard marriage mattress. Frex wonders if his prediction that the devil was coming caused a window in you to open, letting an imp pass through to spoil the baby, said Nanny. She was crocheting an edge of lace clumsily. She had never excelled at piecework, but she liked handling the polished ivory crochet hook.
"I wonder if you opened another window."
Melina, groggy from pinlobble leaves as usual, arched an eyebrow in confusion.
"Did you sleep with someone other than Frex?" Nanny asked.
"Don't be mad," said Melina.
"I know you, honey," said Nanny.
"I'm not saying you're not a good wife, but when you have the boys buzzing around you in your parents' orchard, you changed your perfumed undergarments more than once a day. You were lusty and sneaky and good at it. I'm not looking down at you, but don't pretend to me that your appetites weren't healthy."
Melina buried her face in the pillow.
"Oh, for those days," she wailed. "It's not that I don't love Frex, but I hate being better than the local peasant idiots."
"Well, now this green child brings you down to their level, you ought to be pleased," said Nanny meanly.
"Nanny, I love Frex, but he leaves me alone so often. I would kill for some tinker to pass by and sell me more than a tin coffee pot. I would pay well for someone less godly and more imaginative."
"That's a question for the future," said Nanny sensibly. "I'm asking you about the past, the recent past, since your marriage."
But Melina's face was vague and blurry. She nodded, she shrugged, she rocked her head.
"The obvious theory is an elf," said Nanny.
"I wouldn't have sex with an elf," Melina shrieked.
"No more would I," said Nanny. "But the green does give one pause. Are there elves in the neighborhood?"
"There's a gaggle of them, tree elves, up over the hill someplace. But if possible, they are more moronic than the fair citizens of Rush Margins. Really, Nanny, I've never even seen one, or only from a distance. The idea is repulsive. Elves giggle at everything. Do you know that? One of them falls out of an oak and smashes his skull like a rotten turnip, and they gather and giggle and then forget about him. It's insulting of you even to bring it up."
"Get used to it if we don't find a way out of this quagmire."
"Well, the answer is no."
"Then someone else, someone handsome enough on the outside, but carrying a germ that maybe you caught."
Melina looked shocked. She hadn't thought of her own health since Elphaba was born. Could she be at risk?
"The truth," said Nanny, "we must know."
"The truth," said Melina distantly.
"Well, it is unknowable."
"What are you trying to say?"
"I don't know the answer to your question."
And Melina explained. Yes, the cottage was off the beaten track. And, of course, She never passed more than the curtest greetings with local farmers and fishermen and thickheads. But more travelers took to the hills and woods than you would credit. Often she had sat, listless and lonely, while Frex was off preaching. And she had found comfort in giving passers-by a simple meal and a buoyant conversation. "And more?" But on those boring days, Melina muttered, she had taken to chewing pinlobble leaves. When she would awake, because the sun was setting, or Frex was there frowning or grinning at her, she remembered little.
"You mean you indulged in adultery, and you don't even have the benefit of a good saucy memory about it?"
Nanny was scandalized.
"I don't know that I did," said Melina. "I wouldn't choose to. I mean, not if I was thinking clearly. But I remember once when a tinker with a funny accent gave me a draught of some heady brew from a green glass bottle. And I had rare expansive dreams, Nanny, of the other world. Cities of glass and smoke, noise and color. I tried to remember."
"So you could well have been raped by elves. Won't your grandfather be pleased to learn how Frex is taking care of you?"
"Stop!" cried Melina.
"Well, I don't know what's to be done." Nanny lost her temper at last. "Everyone's being irresponsible. If you can't remember whether your marriage vows have been broken or not, there's not much good in acting like an offended saint."
"We can always drown the baby and start over."
"Just try drowning that thing," muttered Nanny. "I pity the poor lake asked to take her in."
Later, Nanny went through Melina's small collection of medicines, herbs, drops, roots, brandies, leaves. She was wondering, without much hope, if she could invent something that might cause the girl's skin to blanch. In the back of the chest, Nanny found the green glass bottle spoken of by Melina. The light was bad, and her eyes weren't strong, but she could make out the words "Miracle Elixir" on a piece of paper pasted to the front. Though she had a native skill in healing, Nanny was unable to come up with a skin-changing potion. Bathing the child in cow's milk didn't make the skin white either. But the child would not allow herself to be lowered into a pail of lake water. She twisted like a cat in panic. Nanny kept on with the cow's milk. It left a horrid sour stink if she did not rub it off thoroughly with a cloth. Frex organized an exorcism. It involved candles and hymns. Nanny watched from a distance. The man was beady-eyed, perspiring with effort, even though the mornings were colder and colder. Elphaba slept in her binding cloth in the middle of the carpet, oblivious to the sacrament. Nothing happened. Frex fell exhausted and spent, and cradled his green daughter within the crook of his arm, as if finally embracing the proof of some undisclosed sin. Melina's face hardened. There was only one thing left to try. Nanny gathered the courage to bring it up on the day she was to leave back for Colwyn grounds.
"We see that peasant treatments don't work," said Nanny, "and spiritual intercession has failed. Do you have the courage to think about sorcery? Is there someone local who could magic the green venom out of the child?"
Frex was up and lashing out at Nanny, swinging his fists. Nanny fell backward off her stool, and Melina bobbed about her, shrieking.
"How dare you!" cried Frex. "In this household! Isn't this green girl insult enough? Sorcery is the refuge of the amoral. When it isn't out-and-out charlatanism, it is dangerously evil. Contracts with the demons!"
Nanny said, "Ooh, preserve me, you fine, fine man. Don't you know enough to fight fire with fire?"
"Nanny, enough," said Melina.
"Hitting a feeble old woman," said Nanny, hurt, "who only tries to help."
The next morning, Nanny packed her valise.
There was nothing more that she could do, and she wasn't willing to live the rest of her life with a fanatical hermit and a ruined baby, even for the sake of Melina. Frex drove Nanny back to the inn at Stonespar End for the coach and four to take her home. Nanny knew Melina might still think about killing the child, but somehow she doubted it. Nanny held her valise to her ample bosom, fearing bandits again. Inside her valise was hidden her gold garter. She could always claim it had been planted there without her knowledge, whereas it would have been hard to claim it had been planted on her leg in the same circumstances. She also had squirreled away the ivory crochet hook, three of Frex's prayer beads, because she liked the carvings, and the pretty green glass bottle left behind by some itinerant salesman, selling apparently dreams and passion and somnolence. She didn't know what she thought. Was Elphaba devil's spawn? Was she half-elf? Was she punishment for her father's failure as a preacher, or for her mother's sloppy morals and bad memory? Or was she merely a physical ailment, a blight, like a misshapen apple or a five-legged calf? Nanny knew her worldview was foggy and chaotic, pestered by demons, faith, and folk science. It didn't escape her attention, however, that both Melina and Frex had believed uncompromisingly that they would have a boy. Frex was the seventh son of a seventh son, and to add to that powerful equation, he was descended from six ministers in a row. Whatever child of either or any sex could dare follow in so auspicious a line. Perhaps, thought Nanny, little green Elphaba chose her own sex and her own color, and to hell with her parents. The Quaddling Glassblower. For one short wet month, early in the next year, the drought lifted. Spring tipped in like green well water, frothing at the hedges, bubbling at the roadside, splashing from the cottage roof in garlands of ivy and string flower. Melina went about the yard in a state of mild undress, so that she could feel the sun on her pale skin and the deep warmth she had missed all winter. Strapped in her chair in the doorway, Elphaba, now a year and a half old, hit her breakfast minnow with the bowl of her spoon. "Oh, eat the thing, don't mash it," said Melina, but mildly. Since the child's chin sling had been removed, mother and daughter had begun to pay some attention to each other. To her surprise, Melina sometimes found Elphaba endearing, the way a baby should be. This view was the only thing she had seen since leaving the elegant mansion of her family, the only thing she would ever gaze upon again. The windswept surface of Ilswater, the distant dark stone cottages and chimneys of rush margins on the other side, the hills lying in a torpor beyond. She would go mad. The world was nothing but water and want. If a frolic of elves scampered through the yard, she would leap on them for company, for sex, for murder. "Your father is a fraud," she said to Elphaba. "Off finding himself all winter, leaving me with only you for company. Eat that breakfast, for you'll get no more if you throw it on the ground." Elphaba picked up the fish and threw it on the ground. "Your father is a charlatan," continued Melina. "He used to be very good in bed for a religious man, and this is how I know his secret. Holy men are supposed to be above earthly pleasures, but your father enjoyed his midnight wrestling. Once upon a time. We must never tell him we know he's a humbug. It would break his heart." "We don't want to break his heart, do we?" And then Melina burst into a high peal of laughter. Elphaba's face was unsmiling, unchanging. She pointed to the fish. "Breakfast, breakfast in the dirt, breakfast for the bugs," Melina said. She dropped the collar of her spring robe a little lower, and the pink yoke of her bare shoulders gyrated. "Shall we go walk by the edge of the lake today, and maybe you'll drown?" But Elphaba would never drown, never, because she would not go near the lake. "Maybe we'll go out in a boat and tip over," Melina shrieked. Elphaba cocked her head to one side, as if listening for some part of her mother not intoxicated with leaves and wine. The sun swept out from behind a cloud. Elphaba scowled. Melina's robe dropped lower. Her breasts worked their way out from between the dirty ruffles of the collar. "Look at me," thought Melina, "showing my breasts to the child I couldn't give milk to for fear of amputation. I, who was the rose of Nest Hardings, I, who was the beauty of my generation, and now I am reduced to company I don't even want, my own squirming, thorny little girl. She is more grasshopper than girl, with those angular little thighs, those arching eyebrows, those poking fingers. She's about the business of learning like any child, but she takes no delight in the world. She pushes and breaks and nibbles on things without any pleasure, as if she has a mission to taste and measure all the disappointments of life, in which rushed margins is amply supplied. Mercy from the unnamed god, she's a creep. She is. She is. Or we might take a walk in the woods today and pick the last of the winter berries." Melina was full of guilt at her lack of motherly feeling. "We can put them in a pie. Can we put them in a pie? Shall we, honey?" Elphaba didn't speak yet, but she nodded and began to wiggle to get down. Melina started a clapping game Elphaba took no notice of. The child grunted and pointed to the ground and arched her long, elegant legs to illustrate her desire. Then she gestured to the gate leading from the kitchen garden and the henyard. There was a man at the uprights of the gate, leaning, shy and hungry-looking, with skin the color of roses at twilight, a dusky, shadowy red. He had a couple of leathern satchels on his shoulders and back, and a walking staff, and a dangerously handsome, hollow-looking face. Melina screeched and caught herself, directed her voice to a lower register. It had been so long since she had spoken to anyone but a whining toddler. "Good glory! You startled us," she cried. "Are you searching for some breakfast?" She had lost the social touch. For instance, her breasts should not be staring at him so, yet she did not clasp her gown. "Please to forgive a sudden appearance by a strange foreigner at Lady's Gate," said the man. "Forgiven, of course," she said impatiently. "Come in where I can see you. Come in, come in." Elphaba had seen so few other people in her life that she hid one eye behind her spoon and peeked with the other eye. The man approached. His movements showed the clumsiness of exhaustion. He was large of ankle and thick of foot, slender about the waist and shoulders, and thick again in the neck, as if he had been made on a lathe and worked too briefly at the extremities. His hands, letting down the satchels, seemed like beasts with minds of their own. They were outsized and splendid. "Traveler not to know where he is," said the man. "Two nights to cross the hills from downhill Cornings, to look for the inn at Three Dead Trees, to rest." "You're lost. You've veered," said Melina, deciding not to be perplexed at his scrambled words. "No matter. Let me fix you a meal, and you can tell me your story." Her hands were at her hair, which once used to be thought precious as spun brass. At least it was clean. The man was sleek and fit, When he removed his cap, his hair fell out in greasy hanks, sunset red. He washed at the pump, stripping off his shirt, and Melina noticed it was nice to see a waist on a man again. Frex, bless him, had run to plumpness in the year and some since Elphaba's birth. Were all quadlings this delicious, dusty rose color? The man's name, Melina learned, was Turtleheart, and he was a glassblower from Ovals in little-known quadling country. She bundled up her breasts at last, reluctantly. Elphaba squawked to be let loose, and without so much as flinching, the visitor unbuckled her and swept her in the air and caught her again. The child crowed with surprise, even delight, and Turtleheart repeated the trick. Melina took advantage of his concentration on the brat to scoop up the uneaten minnow from the dirt and rinse it off. She plopped it among the eggs and mashed tar root, hoping that Elphaba would not suddenly learn to speak and embarrass her. It would be just like the child to do that. But Elphaba was too charmed by this man to fuss or complain. She didn't even whine when Turtleheart finally came to the bench and sat to eat. She crawled between his sleek, hairless calves, for he had chucked off his leggings, and she moaned some private tune with a satisfied smirk on her face. Melina found herself jealous of a female not yet 2 years old. She wouldn't have minded sitting on the ground between Turtleheart's legs. "I've never met a quadling before," she said, too loudly, too brightly. The months of solitude had made her forget her manners. "My family would never have quadlings in to dine. Not that there were many, or even any, for all I know, in the farmlands around my family's estate. The stories make out that quadlings were sneaky and incapable of telling the truth." "How can a quadling to answer such a charge, if a quadling is given always to lie?" he smiled at her. She melted like butter on warm bread. "I'll believe anything you say." He told her of the life in the outreaches of Ovals, the houses rotting gently into the swamp, the harvest of snails and murkweed, the customs of communal living and ancestor worship. "So you believe your ancestors are with you?" she prodded. "I don't mean to be nosy, but I've become interested in religion despite myself."
"Does Lady to believe ancestors are with her?"
She could hardly focus on the question, so bright were his eyes, and so wonderful it was to be called Lady. Her shoulders straightened. "My immediate ancestors couldn't be farther away," she admitted. "I mean my parents. They're still living, but so uninteresting to me they might as well be dead."
"When dead, they may to visit Lady often."
"They are not welcome. Go away," she laughed, shooing. "You mean ghosts? They'd better not. That's what I'd call the worst of both worlds, if there is an other land."
"There is an other world," he said with certainty.
She felt chilled. She scooped Elphaba up and hugged her tightly. Elphaba sagged as if boneless in her arms, neither fussing nor returning the hug, just falling limp from the novelty of being touched. "Are you a seer?" said Melina.
"Turtleheart to blow glass," he said.
He seemed to mean that as an answer. Melina was suddenly reminded of the dreams she used to have, of exotic places she knew she was too dull to invent. "Married to a minister, and I don't know that I believe in another world," she admitted. She hadn't meant to say that she was married, although she supposed the child implicated her. But Turtleheart had finished talking. He put down his plate, he had left the minnow, and he took from his satchels a small pot, a pipe, and some sacks of sand and soda ash and lime and other minerals.
"Might Turtle Heart to thank Lady for her welcome?" he asked. She nodded.
He built up the kitchen fire and sorted and mixed his ingredients and arranged utensils and cleaned the bowl of his pipe with a special rag folded in its own pouch. Elphaba sat clump-like, her green hands on her green toes, curiosity on her sharp, pinched face. Melina had never seen glass blown, just as she had never seen paper made, cloth woven, or logs hewn from tree trunks. It seemed as marvelous to her as the local stories of the traveling clock that had hexed her husband into the professional paralysis from which he still hadn't quite escaped, though he tried. Turtle Heart hummed a note through his nose, or the pipe as he blew an irregular bulb of hot, greenish ice. It steamed and hissed in the air. He knew what to do with it. He was a wizard of glass. Melina had to hold Elphaba back to keep her from burning her hands as she reached for it. In what seemed like no time at all, in what felt like magic, the glass had gone from being semi-liquid and abstract to a hardening, cooling reality. It was a smooth, impure circle, like a slightly oblong plate. All the while Turtle Heart worked with it, Melina thought of her own character, going from youthful ether to hardening shell, transparently empty, breakable too. But before she could lose herself in remorse, Turtle Heart took her two hands and passed them near, but not touching, the flat surface of the glass.
"Lady to talk with ancestors," he said.
But she would not struggle to connect with old, boring, dead people in the other land, not when his huge hands covered hers. She breathed through her nose to suppress the smell of breakfast in an unwashed mouth, fruit and one glass of wine, or was it two? She thought she might well faint.
"Look in glass," he urged her.
She could only look at his neck and his raspberry honey-colored chin. He looked for her. Elphaba came and steadied herself with a small hand on his knee, and peered in, too.
"Husband is near," said Turtle Heart.
Was this prophecy through a glass dish, or was he asking her a question? But he went on.
"Husband is traveling on a donkey, and to bring elderly woman to visit you. Is ancestor to visit?"
"Is old nursemaid, probably," Melina said. She was sloping downward into his crippled syntax in unabashed sympathy. "Can you really to see that in there?" He nodded. Elphaba nodded too, but at what? "How much time do we have before he gets here?" she asked.
"Till this evening."
They did not speak another word until sunset. They banked the fire and hooked Elphaba to a harness, and sat her down in front of the cooling glass, which they hung on a string, like a lens or a mirror. It seemed to mesmerize and calm her. She did